Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. I enjoy so much the series that we do called Conversations with Remarkable Minds, because it allows us to hear from individuals who have something to say that is so relevant, instead of the usual talking heads, the same people you hear on the conservative and liberal radio. And we seek these people out because we believe we can grow from them. Today, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, a conversation about humanism as a philosophical moral path for living a fulfilling life and the dangers of religion if it's literal. And I will have Professor Anthony Grayling, a professor of philosophy at St. Ames College at Oxford University and Birkbeck College at the University of London. In the UK and through much of Europe, he is the household name and appears frequently on Medium, and he's written over 30 books on philosophy and other subjects dealing with liberty and terror, social justice, and the big ideas that have shaped the course of humanity and civilization. Professor Grayling is the Honorary Secretary of England's preeminent philosophical association, and he is past chairman of the June 4th, a human rights organization. So that will be our conversation. I'm going to go to him early. Health and nutrition first, of course, as always, but nothing else. Let's begin. I wrote my first report on mercury almost 30 years ago. My doctoral dissertation was on the impact of mercury in our bodies. As a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was able to do research on mercury, and we had a group of individuals who we did all their blood workups, took the mercury out of their teeth, eliminated mercury from their diet, and saw major improvements, including neurological improvements, energy improvements. Clearly, there was a manifestation when you get the mercury out of your body. On the other end of that, the American Dental Association and most dentists refused to acknowledge that the mercury in silver fillings, which represent about 52% of the actual filling, was of danger. I never will forget working with a family in Connecticut. I was actually approached by a daughter who had multiple sclerosis, and it was advanced multiple sclerosis. Her father had been a physician for 30 years and was having trouble because of excruciating arthritis that was causing his fingers and joints to swell up so bad that he was considering retiring. I suggested that he should consider allergy testing. I found an allergist, a Dr. Marshall Mandel, and fortunately Dr. Mandel filmed the experiment. What he did was, he had the person stand and sit in a chair and walk a short distance in a room and back. There was a clock on the wall behind with a very prominent second hand. He then brought in a series of bottles, small bottles, much like you would drop eye drops from. And he then took a single drop out of a bottle and put it under the man's tongue, and then said, stand and walk. And the person, the doctor, did this with no effort. And then one of the bottles, when the drop went under the tongue, he didn't get up so easily. He was wobbly. And then you're looking at the clock, and it took about four times longer to walk the room and back and sit in the chair. He was giving a neutralized dose. They then wrote down the number on the bottom of the bottle. They then went in the other room, and a nurse mixed the bottles up again and repeated it again. No problem until a drop, a single drop, from one bottle caused the same identical symptoms. And you can see that he's walking very wobbly. And again, it was written down. No matter how many times this was done, the same impact. It turns out when it was decoded, and this was a double-blind study, the doctor didn't know what was in the bottles, nor what the numbers referred to. Another person did. It was beef. The man had a severe reaction to beef. And so he was put on a beef-free diet. And lo and behold, within the next 2 weeks, his pain was gone, his joint movement improved, and about 3 months went by, and then he had an emergency. And he was confused, the doctor was, because the pain occurred again. And he said, but I haven't eaten any beef at all. But he didn't consider the gelatin that was used in a dessert. And that's from beef. So when the gelatin was removed, he returned to good health. His wife had had constant years and years of gastrointestinal problems. She was put on a cleansing healing diet, and she improved so she no longer had symptoms. But then the daughter came to me, and while I was talking with her, I saw that her whole mouth was filled with several fillings. And I said, how long have you had it? And she told me, and I said, would you consider having all of your silver fillings removed from a holistic dentist? And she did. And then she was given chelation therapy, EDTA, ethylene diamine tetracetic acid, intravenous. And I think she had about 60 treatments with a local physician. It reversed her multiple sclerosis, so much so that when we had the big all-day 12-hour conference with all the holistic doctors in the world who had proven their therapy, Dr. Joseph Issels, Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski, Dr. Al-Kaidi, all of them were invited, Dr. Livingston Wheeler, Dr. Lawrence Burton, and they spent the day. She came up on the stage, and I introduced her, and she brought her crutches and showed that she no longer had to use them. And the mercury was the key. I could have given her the best diet in the world. I could have given her all the supplements and herbs. As long as the mercury was in the body, it's a neurotoxin. Therefore, I'm saying, unequivocally and absolutely, that silver fillings are neurotoxic. And the information you've been given by your dentist, that they are safe, that they don't leak, is wrong. Because when studies have been done and published in the peer-reviewed literature, in sheep, it was shown that with a highly sensitive breath analyzer, mercury vapors occur in the body, and you breathe them right up into the brain. That said, this is the latest. I thought you'd find this of interest, and we thank the Sleuth Journal for sharing this with us. Here's what it says. Do you have mercury fillings in your mouth? Have you had mercury fillings in your mouth at any time in the past? Do you have gas, bloating, or indigestion? Do you get the cold or flu often? If so, there are a couple really important things that you need to know about mercury and its effect on your body. Mercury is one of the most toxic substances on the planet. The American Dental Association has long said that mercury fillings or amalgams are harmless. Quote, dental amalgam is considered a safe, affordable, and durable material that has been used to restore the teeth for more than 100 million people. End quote. This doesn't make one iota of sense. This is the equivalent of saying smoking cigarettes is good for your health. How can one of the most toxic substances in the world sit in your mouth and not have an effect on your health, especially being inches from your brain? Without exposure to anything, they say it is harmless. They are right. However, in the human mouth, it doesn't just sit there. Two main things cause vapors to be released: heat and friction. You would never be able to consume something warm or eat ever again. Take an amalgam in your hand and rub it on it with a spoon or a knife and use an instrument to test the vapor that was released. The amount of mercury released by this friction releases 500% of what would be considered safe level of vapor by the Occupational Safety Hazard Administration. This happens in the mouth many times a day. Hence, it is far from harmless. Mercury damages the tissue as well as tissues around it. Clinically, it damages the things that are closest first and then moves to further parts of the body. The sublingual and parotid gland are the first parts to be affected. Other parts are the eyes, sinuses, the brain, and the thyroid. Once the damage is done for mercury, it is like glue And when it comes to other parts of the body, it stays there. Heavy metals must be chelated or removed from the body. Mercury doesn't leave the body unless you are targeting it specifically. Damaged tissues need direct support to be regenerated. Eating good organic food, exercising, juicing, and taking good quality whole food supplements is not enough to repair the damage. Mercury fillings damage, and they do a really great job of it. The parotid gland is the largest salivary gland in the mouth. It has so many fascinating and critical functions for the health of the body. This is important for three main reasons. Digestion. Do you get gas? Do you get bloated? Do you have indigestion? All of these symptoms can be the result of good or poor digestion or not breaking down food. The parotid gland emits amylase, which is the primary enzyme that helps your body break down carbohydrates. The breakdown of food is critical if you want to absorb and metabolize your food. Many naturopaths have long believed that impaired digestion is the start of what brings on most diseases in the body. The other component is the saliva. It helps to clean the upper digestive tract as well. Then secondly, you have the immune system. The parotid gland emits lysosome, which is an organelle that contains enzymes our body has against things our body doesn't like that enters into our mouths. This is why they are commonly called suicide sacs. The lysosomes gets rid of waste and cellular debris, which leads to our next point. The lysosome is thought to be critical to help the body detoxify from heavy metals and heavy chemicals. It may serve as one of the most critical ways our body naturally detoxifies. The function of the parotid gland is therefore critical for digestion, your immune function, and detoxification. Its role cannot be understated. And then it goes on to talk about, you know, why this is so important. So here's the message. We've been lied to so often by so many official sources when it comes to health issues. Saccharin, cyclamates, synthetic hormone replacement, the amount of protein we need, the types of protein and carbohydrate we should ingest, according to government sources, all create disease because they're not impartial. So get the mercury out of your mouth. Holistic dentists are able to do it. And then you can rebuild your system and detoxify from there. This I found of interest. This is from Victoria Ward of the Telegraph. Toddlers becoming so addicted to iPads, they require therapy. Quote, children as young as 4 are becoming so addicted to smartphones and iPads that they require psychological treatment. Experts have warned that parents who allow babies and toddlers to access tablet computers for several hours a day are in danger of causing dangerous long-term effects. The youngest known patient being treated is a 4-year-old girl from the Southeast. Her parents enrolled her for compulsive behavior therapy after she became increasingly distressed and inconsolable when the iPad was taken away from her. Her use of the device had escalated over the course of a year, and she became addicted to using it for up to 4 hours a day. Dr. Richard Graham launched the first technology addiction program 3 years ago, said he believed that there were many more addicts of her age. Quote, the child's mother called me and described her symptoms. She told me that she had developed an obsession with the device and would ask for it continuously. She was using it 3 or 4 hours every day and showed increasing agitation if removed. Dr. Graham said that young technology addicts experience the same withdrawal symptoms as alcoholics or heroin addicts when the devices were taken away. He warned that the condition prevented young people from forming normal social relationships, leaving them drained by the constant interaction. Now, think about this. I was in a popular Upper West Side vegan restaurant a few nights ago. Not happy with the service, but then again, it didn't matter. The younger people in the restaurant were happy because they don't have a standard for service. Not necessarily happy with the quality of food, much of it fried and a lot of it based upon seitan. In my personal opinion, having seitan on a menu means you have a lazy chef. There's so many more interesting sources of protein to offer, but it means you can't just take a slab of seitan, which is a wheat protein. Lots of problems there, especially for those who are trying to be free of the consequences of gluten. And they just deep fry it. Well, you deep fry something, you throw some salt and pepper in there, and you crisp it up. You know, you put some kind of dressing on it. It'll taste fine. And it's especially good for people who like chicken and meat and don't want to live with the idea that somehow they're being highly ethical because they're not eating an animal, but they're not highly smart because they're causing all kinds of problems with that seitan. In any case, there's so many other ways that are healthier to get your protein, but that, again, if you're not going to have good service, you're not going to care about the quality of your menu, and you're very popular, then you have a winning formula. But what I was noticing is how many people were talking at the same time they were using their smartphones. It was probably the majority of people. And I was thinking to myself, what would happen if those people went to a meal and left their cell phone at home? In fact, what would happen if we simply stopped using our cell phones when we went out? For any social occasion, we feel we must constantly be attached to something. Everywhere you look, every time I get in the elevator in my building, if there's a person there, they're doing something on their cell phone. I believe that we should start weaning ourselves away. And if you're out with someone, be with that person. If you're having a meal, be aware of the meal, the quality of the food, and most importantly, the quality of the companionship that you're with someone. Try that. Otherwise, I believe that what they're seeing in this particular study is going to be an absolute phenomena. And how many of the children out there and college kids are sleeping with their cell phone right beside their head? I've now heard of 3 cases of brain cancer brought to my attention in the last 7 days alone. The oldest person was 17, the youngest was 12. I believe that we're in the middle of an epidemic of electromagnetic pulse cancer, and it's only going to get worse. What would happen if people went to bed to get a good night's sleep, put their cell phones away, turn them off, turn off their computers? This is one of those moments where we have to consider, are we doing that? Now, a University of Southern California study I found of interest because it said natural processes discovered that blocks viruses. Gee whiz. I remember Linus Pauling showing me that with quercetin at high doses, he was able to block multiple viruses in his laboratory. Here's what this says. Quote, the human body has the ability to ward off viruses by activating a naturally occurring protein at the cellular level, setting off a chain reaction that disrupts the levels of cholesterol required in cell membranes to enable viruses to enter cells. The findings discovered by researchers in molecular microbiology and immunology at the Keck School of Medicine, UC California, hold promise for the development of therapies to fight a variety of viral infections. Previous studies have shown that our bodies are already equipped to block viruses such as Ebola, influenza, West Nile, and SARS, said the principal investigator, distinguished professor and chair of molecular biology and microbiology and immunology. The antiviral effector, IFITM3, disrupts intercellular cholesterol homeostasis to block viral entry. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Host and Microbe. Okay. Well, how about this? Why don't they try using bitter melon juice and high levels of vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C? That also not just blocks viruses, it kills pathogenic viruses. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. like to welcome all of you all over the world. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City. In just a moment, we're going to our guest, who is standing by in London for our discussion, a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds, Professor Anthony Grayling, professor of philosophy at St. Anne's College at Oxford University and Birkbeck College at the University of London, author of so many books, and the most recently being The God Argument, The Case Against Religion for Humanism, which presents the case against scriptural literalism and religious creationism and other beliefs, and presents humanism as a viable path for living a fulfilling life. Just two quick program announcements. One is, if you have not downloaded our program from Earth Day with Jane Goodall and Vandana Shiva, you should listen. It's a powerful program. But I did two programs on Earth Day, the evening one being our Progressive Commentary Hour. And that, Professor Emeritus, one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had. He was not optimistic about our future and says that based upon how quickly we're reaching the 4 degrees Celsius increase, we're going to have major problems to face. So worth listening to. Also, this coming Saturday at 7 p.m., I'll be in Woodstock at the Woodstock Community Center screening Seeds of Death about GMO foods. There are no reservations for this event. It's a first-come, first-served basis. I look forward to seeing you there. And also, my lecture today at A Matter of Health Natural Food Store in Nanuet has been canceled for this evening due to emergency repairs in the store. When I come back from my next filming, I'll reschedule. And next week, we're full. We've been full. That's why I haven't mentioned it, for the screening in New York City at the Theater for the New City, screening Seeds of Death Tuesday, the 30th at 7:30 p.m. If you can't come and you've made a reservation, please call, because we've been flooded with calls of people want to attend, but it's full, and I want to be able to free up a few seats. So if you're not coming, call 212-254-1109 and surrender your seats so someone can come. Thank you. Now let's go over and say hello to Professor Anthony Grayling. Nice to have you back with us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. Since we'll be speaking about humanism as a belief people can follow to feel no sentiment towards religion, and primarily in the atheistic context, I would like to begin with a recent news item in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing. Harvard University has perhaps the largest divinity school in the nation, and the school also employs an atheist humanism chaplain to advise its atheist students. And to honor the marathon victims, the school held an interfaith gathering of its chaplains and religious professors and the audience, but refused to invite this humanist chaplain. So my question first is, why is there such a great animosity among most but not all religious leaders towards atheism as a viable belief to follow, and then provide the case for humanism as being an authentic life path and belief for people to follow? And in your answer, since you're a highly acknowledged philosopher and classicist, give us a little background of early schools and proponents of humanism in earlier or more ancient history.
Well, let me begin by saying, Gary, that humanism is not so much a doctrine or a teaching. It doesn't really have a set of prescriptions about how one should live or a set of rules or do's and don'ts. It's much more an attitude, really, to life. It begins by constituting itself as a challenge for people to think about the values they're going to live by, to think about the relationships that they form with others. And it asks us to try to do that on the basis of our most generous and sympathetic understanding of what it is to be human, given that human beings are, you know, capable of enormous creativity and affection, but also, of course, their human nature is an alloy, so they're also capable of doing bad things too. And humanism has its roots in very ancient thinking about the ethical life. I quite often nominate Socrates as the person who got the debate going about how we should live, what goals are worthwhile, what kind of life is a flourishing life, both in its felt capacity as something worthwhile to have and to do, but also in its relationships with others. Because what Socrates did to his fellow Athenians was he challenged them. He challenged them to think a little bit about why they did what they did, what ideas they used, ideas of courage, generosity, temperance, continence, when they were trying to shape their moral lives. And that challenge, the challenge to think for oneself and to work out something which is genuinely viable, is at the very heart of the humanist program.
Okay, right on that one. I'd like, if you would please, to critique from a humanist perspective the scriptural literalism, because even more important than believing in creationism and the age of the universe as only 5,000 or so BC, literalism has the greatest adverse impact upon society. As you know, in Kentucky, there's a creation museum, a multi-million-dollar religious amusement park, attracting millions of people annually, to be flooded with legends and myths portrayed as historical facts, such as dinosaurs frolicking with Adam and Eve. And just last month, the Pew Research Center survey found that 48% of Christians believe Jesus will return in the next 40 years. That is a lot of people, given the U.S. Is a large Christian country. How do you explain this irrationality in believing scriptures literally in the face of so much evidence to the contrary?
Well, as with most things, the explanation is an over-determining one, in the sense that there are many strands to it, and any subset of those strands would be enough to make people embrace views of this kind. One has to remember that the vast majority of people have the religious outlook they do because they were born into it, because their parents had that outlook. And children, for very good evolutionary reasons, are highly credulous. They're built to believe everything that the adults in their circle tell them for their own survival. Fire burns, you mustn't fall into the deep pond if you can't swim, that kind of thing. It's tremendously important for them to accept all that, and they accept, therefore, the religious teachings that their parents and others give them. About the age of 10 or 11, the Tooth Fairy and Father Christmas tend to drop away, but there's a massive social reinforcement of religious beliefs. All around us in towns, there are church spires and synagogues and mosques. There are grown-ups dressed in robes, leading services at the head of a great congregation. So all these things seem to reinforce the plausibility of religion. And most people, I suppose, find their religious beliefs becoming a little bit tenuous at the maximum time of courting, I suppose, when you're in the first flush of romantic love. Religion tends to get in the way a little bit. But later on, when there is a disaster, grief is experienced, or the loss of a job, or depression, tragedy, people very naturally go back to the religions of their childhoods. Very infrequently do they go on to some other religion. They may. I mean, there are some converts from Christianity to Islam and so on, but that's actually a very small minority of people overall. So add to this the fact that you can explain to anybody the tenets of a major religion, any major religion, in less than half an hour, and contrast that with the fact that it takes years, really, to get deep insights in physics and biochemistry and the rest. And you can see that the sheer complexity of the kind of knowledge required for a really good understanding of the world drives people towards neat, relatively simple stories, narratives that give closure in our understanding of things. Where do we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? Those sorts of explanations can be satisfying because they're not too intellectually demanding, and they do provide a kind of safety net. So it's understandable. It may not be excusable. That's a different thing. But it's understandable why people might not really want to do the thinking about what they think they believe or what they believe they believe, to explore it right through to its logical conclusion and to try to fit it into a more rational set of views about the world. And that, I think, is what causes and sustains religious belief. And, of course, if you rely on a text like the Bible of religion, the Bible of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and if you're urged by your community, by people you respect and admire, to take it literally, then you're going to find yourself believing some things that, if you weren't in that mindset, you would probably regard as implausible.
I know that in Europe, atheism and non-theism is more popular than the United States. Nevertheless, last year, again, a Pew survey found that the atheist, non-theist, and non-affiliated population had grown to about 20%. The change is mostly people leaving organized religion and faith groups. Atheism is around 7% now, and the remainder are those who no longer call themselves religious but prefer to view themselves as spiritual, which can mean many things. So how do you account for these trends, and what do you believe are the main causative factors for people turning their backs on identifying themselves with a particular religion, much as over 40% of the American population no longer align themselves with conservative or liberal principles, but rather with independent principles of making their decisions?
Yes, this is very interesting what's happening in the U.S., and the Pew data is quite fascinating, actually. One's going to watch over the next few years how these trends develop. Now, you correctly point out that in Europe, and this has been the case increasingly over the last couple of centuries, really since the Enlightenment of the 18th century, that functionally Europe is a very secular sphere. And if you were to stop somebody in the street and say to them, "I'm an atheist," they would say, "So what?" and walk on by. That doesn't worry them at all, and there's so many people are. A lot of people who continue at certain points in the year, like Christmas and Easter, to go to a church service is because they like the music, not because they believe the beliefs. Now, the United States of America was, of course, founded by people in search of religious liberty. The founding fathers had left Europe, had left England, indeed, in order to be able to have the free exercise of their own beliefs. And that built into the very traditions of the U.S. society, despite the constitutional secularity of the U.S., has meant that the very idea of being a good citizen is closely allied to the idea of being somebody who has a religious commitment. These changes that you report from the Pew data show that the shift which has been happening in Europe over a long period has begun to happen in the United States as well. And it's a mark, I think, of, and I just about to make a remark now, which I think is bears much more on the ideas in play and not on individual human beings whom we must acknowledge very often hold their beliefs sincerely or are not themselves personally responsible, given that they've been, in some cases, even brainwashed as children into these beliefs. But the increase of scientific understanding in the world, the broadening of education, little by little it does have the effect of making people tiny little bit more reflective. I mean, Bertrand Russell famously said most people would rather die than think, and most people do, meaning that too few people really sit down properly and vigorously and rigorously look at their beliefs. But little by little, that change feeds into the general consciousness, and so you find a loosening, a feebling of the grip of religious ideologies on people. And I think, Gary, that there's an interesting thing to be said about some of the activism in the Islamic world, which may not be a mark of the recrudescence of real belief, but of anxiety because of the loosening of belief. You know, when people are on the back foot, when they're less secure, when doubts have been raised in their own minds and in their communities about a way of life based on a set of beliefs, some people in that community can become rather anxious and become zealots, become more fiercely committed to their belief in the hope of trying to salvage that belief. So it may be that we're seeing in the world today, with this rather bad-tempered quarrel between people who have a religious commitment and those who don't, marks of anxiety, marks of defensiveness on the part of those whose desire is for comfort in their religious belief, but they feel under challenge because there are so many cogent criticisms and expressions of opinion that differ from them.
I appreciate what you just said. I'm going to ask you to follow up because you mentioned Bertrand Russell, and I, as you, believe that he was of a great mind, and one of the principles of his humanism was the need to generate our deeper values from human experience and our interfacing with nature and the world around us, including society. But also when you said that there's a moment where those who are deeply religious, where it's not merely a doctrine, it's not merely an indoctrinating principle, it's not merely, let's say, a dogma, it is the absolute reason for their existence. That's also true in Judaism, it's true in Christianity, it's true in many of the religions, where others in that same religion, especially, let's say, in Christianity or in Judaism, where you will have an ultra-Orthodox, an Orthodox, a conservative, you know, an observant Jew, and then one that's very liberal and lives by moral principles, but not necessarily religious dogma. When we see the Taliban taking back power in different areas of Afghanistan, their fight was not the United States. Their fight was those who were within the religion who began to become more moderate, became more free. They started, demanding men grow their beards. They would shut down barbershops. They demanded you couldn't listen to music. They demanded women couldn't work. They demanded that you couldn't be seen in public unless you were in the immediate accompaniment of a male in your immediate family. And otherwise, you could be arrested and beaten. That is still true in Saudi Arabia. We didn't even discuss in the American media how Saudi Arabia has beheaded more people in the last year than any other country because we do business with them. So on the one hand, and Wahhabism is an extreme example of that, but on the one hand, think of those people that will do anything that when they feel threatened, that their absolute religious beliefs no longer have the power that they once had, or the younger people within their religions are now looking elsewhere because social media has opened the gateway to show that you do not have to be religious to be spiritual. You do not have to be religious to have feelings, to coexist. So I see, on the one hand, much of our violence in the world perpetrated by the ultra-Orthodox in all religions, and it was the ultra-Orthodox also in Christianity that led to some of the most heinous crimes against people. Your thoughts on this, please.
You're absolutely right about this. And the problem identified by Sam Harris, for example, is that moderate forms of religion, and now, again, without wishing to disrespect individuals, but looking at a sociological phenomenon here, moderate forms of religion are moderate because they cherry-pick the teachings of their religion. A moderate, kind, charitable, Sunday observant Christian, for example, would not accept many of the things that are said in the Bible, like, for example, stoning gay people to death. They would, reject that. But in doing so, of course, they are choosing those bits of the teachings which are easy to live by and which are acceptable, and rejecting others. So moderate forms of religion tend to be like that, and they therefore give a kind of mask to the long tail behind them, at the very end of which, of course, are these people who are not merely prepared to die for their faith, but to kill for their dogma. And they are the ones who are dangerous and disturbing in our world. And tragically, in the atrocities of 9/11 in the United States, we've seen people prepared to die thinking that they're going to get a great reward for doing it. They really genuinely, sincerely believe it, and that's the frightening thing about them. So it is a huge problem here. The problem of getting at people who have become so self-indoctrinated, they've become so locked into a particular vocabulary, a particular interpretation of things, that they cannot see the world in any other way. They're wearing a very, very thick pair of conceptual spectacles through which the world looks only one way. And the way they think about things is this. At the worst, they're saying, we believe such and such, therefore you are not allowed to think or do or behave in ways that we disapprove of. They want to impose their view on other people, coerce them and corral them. And if they won't agree, they want to punish them. And this, of course, has been a feature of all the major religions throughout history. Christianity, for example, would burn heretics at the stake. What was the heretic's crime? To disagree, to not conform to the orthodoxy. And this is happening in our world today, tragically, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. So we see this mindset in which we have the truth, therefore you must sign up for it, otherwise you're going to be in big trouble. But it's also the case that some of these people have a kind of strand of sincerity in it as well. You know, in those palmy days when the church used to burn heretics, they did it out of what they regarded as kindness. If I kill you now, you're not going to continue to sin so that you're going to have a longer time in purgatory. I'm going to shorten your possibilities of harming yourself by burning you at the stake. I'm going to impose my views on you because I've got the truth and my truth will save you. So I'm going to save you even despite yourself by forcing you to conform. Now that kind of attitude is the attitude of a certain sort of terrible sincerity which imposes itself on other people. And you and I agree, I think, Gary, that individual autonomy, the space around an individual to breathe, to have oxygen, to develop a life which is good and flourishing and good in its effects on others, according to the individual talents that we have and the capacity that we have to identify goals that we can realize in our own lives, is of vital importance to the human spirit, that no human being can be fully human unless they have that opportunity. So to live in a circumstance where there are these people who are determined to force their views on you, and if you won't accept them, to punish you for it, perhaps even to kill you for it, or people who hate you because you won't agree with them. I mean, these are the sort of terrible extremes to which religion can lead people, tragically. And they lie at the end of that long tail, at the front end of which, of course, is all the kindness and the sincerity and the concern and the peacefulness and moderation of people who wouldn't dream of doing those things.
I really appreciate that answer. It was a gift to us, and I thank you. I only have one more question, but you just triggered a whole consciousness raising in me, and I've got to share this with you. Please be patient for just a few moments till I get this out, because I've spent my entire career trying to offer people insights into healthier choices. And historically, virtually all of the people that I'm working with, others have all been shown to be correct. That when we eat healthy, we think healthy, we act healthy, we become healthier. And yet many of the people that will say that we have no basis are the so-called guardians of science. And I'm going to juxtaposition something that you said and put it into a little different context. And I'd like for the people in this audience to think about this for a moment. You state that religionists have, in your work, no respect for science, or little respect for science, and I assume you're referring to those who are more the fundamentalist religious groups, and we know that the extreme religions have no respect for science, except when it comes to someone like the Dalai Lama, who has stated many times his strong support in science, that when science brings forth facts that contradict Buddhist beliefs, then, like the great, in my opinion, a great thinker, great man, Professor Thurman at Columbia University, that he will change then, meaning Buddhist beliefs must change and realign with what we can show as real science. And I believe that that is an excellent example of a realistic, rational way where religion and science can coexist. But my larger issue that I just was thinking when you were talking, I don't think you realize how powerful your words are. There is a concern I have, and that is that the marriage between science and atheism, I place very little value upon what a person's individual religious beliefs or non-beliefs are, either theist or atheist. What I need to discern is the quality of the individual and the morals and values the person upholds in their words and deeds. Are they loving and kind and fight for equality and fight against injustice? Do they stand for truth against power opposing injustices and violence done to those without the power and wealth to defend themselves? And are they the victims of greed and manipulation and deception? And what does that mean to the person? Does whatever the person believes enrich their lives so they can become better human beings? Today, science, in my opinion, I'm speaking subjectively, has turned into an ultra-Orthodox, rabidly radical religion. They call themselves scientisms, and it is reductionistic, it is deterministic, and many of the most outspoken atheists, and I would include Richard Dawkins and Dennard, and the medical biologist Jerry Coney at Chicago, and A.Z. Myers, among others, these are the high priests of this new dogmatic scientific worldview. The Australian philosopher Herbert Feigl, who is also a chemist, wrote something to the quest of for absolute certainty, they are seeking what is immature, if not infantile, a trait of thinking. I'm just paraphrasing him. But when reading any of these individuals I just named, they give a strong indication that they believe that they have reached the apex of absolute certainty in their creed in science's infallibility. In medical, biological, and genetic fields, where the most reductionist and scientific atheists are found. And if you read their blogs, you would think they imagine themselves as the reincarnation of the Inquisition. There is no debate. There is no openness, only character assassinations of others who believe differently than they do. One of your great quantum physicists and mathematicians from the United Kingdom, Freeman Dyson, wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, that the public has a distorted view about scientific thinking and that it represents an established set of truths. However, science is not a collection of truths, but a continuing exploration of mysteries. And I believe the most determinist of scientists, Dawkins and Myers in particular, are unable to understand this because they denounce everything that does not fit into their iron-walled paradigm of what is fact or fiction. The result, for example, has been a rapid attack upon alternative medicine. We may remind ourselves that between 50 and 60% of all drugs that these guys hold up as miracles of scientists find their original compounds in the plant kingdom. They argue that their beliefs are supported by peer-reviewed literature. However, there are many papers, even in peer-reviewed literature, arguing that most published research in medicine is false. It is fraudulent because a poor protocol designed to reach your desired result, and it's proprietary. Whoever pays for the research receives the results they want. And Professor Carl Elliott at the University of Minnesota, who wrote a wonderful book on this topic, has shown that clinical trials today are riddled with corruption and most results are useless. And here is my main issue, and I'm sorry for ruminating my concern. When atheism aligns itself so tightly with scientism then becomes as literalist as scriptural literalism with equal dangers and threats. And one of the primary criticisms of people like Hitchens and Dawkins and Dennard and Sam Harris is their lack of openness to diversity and difference in beliefs that are non-atheistic. And when we close down the inquisitive mind and open-mindedness to explore unresolved scientific mysteries, for example, outright denouncing of homeopathy, which, by the way, the Nobel Prize laureate for the discovery of the HIV virus, Luc Montagnier, recently researched into quantum aspects of water memory, is validating homeopathy, an equally aggressive opposition to the deeper aspects of the placebo effect and the unconfirmed science to understand consciousness and mind-body relationships and healing, and epigenetic science, which actually raises huge concerns about the dangers of vaccines and pesticides and genetically modified foods, and nanomedicine, and many other unresolved riddles that don't fit into reductionist scientism's mindset, then we are going to be at the mercy of unspeakable threats to civilization. So, I will pose that even great dangers of this come from the way we think in science, and science is now our new religion. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you've raised a large number of issues there, and I see I've somehow managed to press several buttons at once of your interests, Gary. But so I'll just pick out one thing, if I may. And that is that whereas I think everybody would agree that scientism, that is the view that science has all the answers about everything, and including answers about aspects of our ethical and political and social lives, which are very difficult to bring into some kind of quantitative framework of explanation. Scientism in that sense, of course, is deeply misguided and can be just as damaging to our thinking as any of the ancient religions might be. But in the case of people like Jerry Coyne and Richard Dawkins, whom I know quite well, I think that the impression that they've given you about their attitudes is an impression derived from the very robust and sometimes acerbic encounters that they have with people, Six-Day Creationists and people like that, who absolutely refuse to accept that there is a kind of responsible, publicly checkable, revisable, open-ended, open-textured method of inquiry which needs to be based on evidence, which has to have the facts and be responsible to them and be ready to be revised in the light of different evidence or further evidence, which is what responsible science involves, and which I really do think that some of the people you've named there would be fully signed up for. But they get angry. I mean, look at Richard Dawkins, for example, who for many decades has been the professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University, trying to point out to people that the concepts and methods of the biological sciences, for example, show us with very great power and overwhelmingly something about how things have worked in the biological realm. And after those many decades, still to be meeting people like Mr. Ham, for example, whom you mentioned earlier as the person who founded the Creation Museum in Kentucky, still to be meeting them is extremely dismaying. And sometimes the rhetorical battle between them can, you know, take rather sort of hard and fast lines. But I do think that if one looks fairly carefully at the kinds of things they say and the commitments they take, that the idea of responsible science, that is, where your hypotheses are open to public and repeatable test by other scientists, where you can be challenged, where you are duty-bound to change your mind if the facts demand of you that you do so. I think some of the people that you've mentioned who have done some interesting work in their own fields would be fully signed up for that. The debate about alternative medicine and that is, I agree with you, a vexed area. There are some, I'm afraid, well-attested cases of charlatanism in that field, others where the results are ambiguous, others yet again where there are not obvious benefits to be derived from it. I suppose because it's such a various and mixed field, it's one where really serious inquiry and investigation is well warranted. But I think that's a different debate. And there are several strands that need to be separated out, and certainly one of them is the one you put your finger on there, scientism, the overweening belief that science is the answer to everything, and responsible science, which I do think people like Jerry Coyne and Richard Dawkins are actually signed up for. Those are two different things. And it's as well to put into context some of the difficulties that particularly people in biology have faced against a well-funded, well-organized, intelligent design stroke creationist lobby trying to get that kind of teaching into schools, trying to oppose what is the overwhelmingly well-attested evidence for an evolutionary interpretation of biology. And so if one could separate rhetoric and the occasional flash of ill temper from what these people have really done and said, it would be helpful.
I appreciate so much your insights. Always look forward to speaking with you, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Many thanks for having me on.
And the book is The God Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism. And my guest, Professor Andrew Grayling, Professor of Philosophy at St. Anne's College at Oxford University and Birkbeck College, University of London, and considered quite possibly one of the greatest philosophers on the planet. This is a continuation of our series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, and I thank everyone for listening. Just one more note. Every day when I come to work, I see so many people in the lobby asking so many questions, and I try to help as many as I can. I have had so many seriously ill people that I try to put my energy helping the most seriously ill and guiding them in the process of their selections and counseling and referrals. But the majority of people don't have terminal conditions. A lot of people are overweight. A lot of people are suffering from fatigue or depression or anxiety, or need to detoxify their bodies. There's so many easy, inexpensive ways of helping a person get well. And so what I've done is I've hired a lot of people who just help these people for free. It's purely a public service. And so instead of coming into the office, see someone that will specifically help guide you. I know people that will come, a woman this morning, just as I was walking my office, she was coming downstairs, and she said, Gary, she said, my problem is simple. I do not have enough money to buy everything I need to be healthy. And I took a moment. I said, all right, how much money do you have to spend on food? And she told me. Then I asked her what she was buying food for her and her son, and she told me. And it was clear that she was spending money in ways that she was not aware, are not giving her good nutrition, and she could have cut her food bill by half. I gave her some suggestions. So what I'd like for you to do, if you want help with health issues, losing weight, getting more energy, better shopping, healthier shopping, making dishes more interesting and tasty, just call. You'll get free help. All right, you go in, not over the phone. And one of those people is Dr. Nadia. She's a psychologist. She graduated top of her class at Albert Einstein School of Medicine and Yeshiva University, and she's taught as an adjunct professor, and she's very good, especially good at helping people who need nutrition advice and de-stressing advice and better shopping advice. She's good, and sometimes when I hire people, I don't always look at the resume because I've seen people with outstanding resumes who could not make the connection. They didn't have that dynamic connection coming from the heart. The people I have do. So, and if you want to call, her number is 646-926-5446. Again, 646-926-5446. Now, let's go in the studio right now. It's talk back time, and it's your opportunity to call in and share your points of view. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And in studio right now is Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Yeah, I've got this article here from the New York Post from last weekend. And, you know, you want to talk about people, their beliefs and how they guide their behaviors and how some people actually go ahead and kill themselves over their beliefs. There is this article about Mayor Bloomberg and how he's trying to come after your trans fats and then your salt and then your soda. And the entire article, Gary, describes how people can get high-fat, high-salt foods anywhere in New York City. And they describe some of the things that people are actually buying. Now, you couldn't believe this unless you saw it yourself. Here's a meatball that they sell for $21. It's a one-pound Kobe meatball slathered in sausage ragu and served with a crown of whipped sheep's milk ricotta. And you ready for this? 2,160 calories, and they sell 500 of these a week. If that doesn't help you, how about a bacon milkshake? This is house-made maple ice cream with 6 ounces of rendered bacon fat, maple syrup, and then a shot of bourbon. It's garnished with cinnamon and sugar and a maple-glazed bacon strip. They sell 200 of these a week, 2,109 calories. I mean, that is murder by burger, and as if this is something that people should buy.
There's a larger issue. On the one hand, I commend the mayor for trying to bring people to a higher level of awareness of the relationship between the food they eat, the beverages they drink, and their state of health. But here is where you have the problem. Step back from the burgers or the Kobe, you know, giant one-pound burgers that the body would still have in its stomach 8 hours later. That could throw your triglycerides right off the roof and cause your homocysteine level to spike, which puts you at a greater risk of a heart attack or stroke. We feel any challenge to our freedom of choice is an assault upon our identity, individually and nationally. So we want our freedom, whatever it may manifest as, and yet where are these same people saying, where is our freedom for the protection of our First, Fourth, Fifth, and Seventh Amendments? Where's the protection for habeas corpus, that if you are arrested, you have a right to a fair trial, you have a right to meet your accusers, you have a right to see the evidence against you? Those same people who are willing to gorge themselves, creating disease, are not willing to look at the other rights that they could also speak up about that are far more important than their dietary rights. Where are the rights of those people to know the truth about silver fillings or the rights of the false information on vaccines? Do they even question this? No. Where are the rights of these people to demand the truth about the state legislators who vote for ALEC-sponsored legislation that impacts them directly at every level? That they will not speak up for, and you will not see two pages of spreads of what people are saying about the loss of freedom, of constitutional rights in the Bill of Rights, and personal rights becoming a fascist state. Yet they want their right to eat themselves to the brink of death. Now then, here's what's not in there. Let me just see that for a moment. Maybe I'm wrong. I just want to see just the end of it. It'll always be at the end.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, right here, the end. No. Here's what's not in this two-page article. I seen the smiling face of this woman about to consume something that could cause a heart attack. I do not see her saying, and I am willing out of my own pocket at no cost to anyone else to pay for all my medical bills. If I am this stupid, if I am this selfish, if I am this greedy, if I am this indifferent to bloat myself to the point of death, I am willing to pay in my own way from my own pocket for the choices I have made. What do you want to bet the same stupid reporter from the same stupid little dirty rag, the New York Post, and these idiots would say we should pay for their medical bills? Those of us who choose to make healthier choices should pay for the disease mongering of those who do not want to make healthy choices. That, to me, is the asinine nature. If you want to get sick, you have a right to. Do not ask me to pay your medical bills in any form, through taxes or anywhere else. You get sick, it's on your dime. Unless it's an accident or something, it's unavoidable.
It's like a selective defiance. Now, if they were...
No, this is just rank stupidity. This doesn't even deserve a response. I'm Gary Nolan. We're out of time. Let us now say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. We're talking today about the T word. T as in terrorism, which for many is itself a political quandary.
Good. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead right now on the Progressive Radio Network.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? Yeah, what's going on, what's going on? Oh, what's going on, what's going on? Right on. They judge us simply 'cause our hair is long. Oh, you know we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. Can't see what's going on.